KPCW News time is 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. So let's find out what we got cooked up for the weather this weekend. On the phone, we have Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, Wasatch back. Good morning, guys. Park City, we've got chance of snow over the weekend. In fact, we're going to see some accumulations Friday night. So tonight into tomorrow, should see a pretty decent ski day tomorrow as well, with temperatures near 33 today ahead of the storm, but dropping to 26 tomorrow, overnight lows near 20. Snow showers again really picking up as a cold front moves through after about 10 or 11 o'clock tonight. So generally 2 to 4 inches for a lot of the mountain valleys with our weekend storm system. Park City could see a little higher amount, maybe 3 to 6. We've got colder air moving in behind the front, though, with northwest flow, keeping a chance of showers in place over the weekend for our mountain areas. We'll see temperatures overnight about 13 Sunday morning to 24 for the high. Could see a little bit of moisture linger into Monday before things clear out. We'll see high pressure take back over. So a bit of an active weekend. Of course, be ready for some winter driving conditions as you're heading out and about in the higher elevations this weekend as well. But by midweek next week, temperatures are back to 36 as we get into Wednesday, and 39 as well on Thursday. Plan on sunshine taking over as well. Heber, sunny today, 34. Overnight lows near 21. 31 tomorrow for the high. Again, generally 2 to 4 inches of snow is expected for Heber. We've got temperatures near 29 on Sunday. Plan on mostly cloudy skies. A few snowflakes lingering. Partly cloudy on Monday, and then sunshine taking over through midweek as well. Should top out at about 37 on Thursday, with 33 on Wednesday next week. Sunshine all next week after some of the clouds on Monday.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Larson, and thanks for bringing us some snow. Let's hope we get some more in the weeks to come.
Yeah, hopefully.
All right.
Thanks.
Have a good weekend. And now we need to check in to see what's going on in the backcountry with this weather pattern. Greg, what are we looking at? We have Greg from the Utah Avalanche Center.
Yeah, good morning. It's always exciting to hear of more snow in the forecast, that's for sure. And for lots of reasons. And, you know, we're continuing to stay at a considerable avalanche danger at the mid and upper elevations on those slopes facing west, north, and east. So we call those the shady slopes, as this time of the year, they still are mostly shady. What we're seeing in observations and reports and field work is that triggering an avalanche on this persistent weak layer, this is a layer of weak, sugary snow buried 3 to 4 feet deep in places now, it's getting harder to trigger an avalanche. So we're seeing signs of strengthening. And in my field work all this week, I'm seeing us move in the right direction. Mm-hmm. But it takes a while to move out of this problem. So I'm still traveling and giving advice that for considerable avalanche danger, that is, if you do trigger an avalanche in one of these northerly facing slopes, these shady slopes, the avalanche can be up to 3-4 feet deep, possibly deeper. And we've had some wind the past few days. We're seeing increasing winds out of the northwest later today. And then you just heard in the forecast, we have more snow on the way. So I think that with we're moving in the right direction, but with more snow and wind on the way, we're gonna stay at considerable. I think it's possible we could be, if the snow comes in on the higher ends, we could be back at high tomorrow. So we're moving in the right direction. I like that. But I think we're just still got to be cautious. Just asking people to be patient. We're getting close. We really are. But people got to be patient. My advice for people is, I think where you're likely to trigger an avalanche is in a thinner snowpack area. And that's going to be at the mid elevations where there's just simply less snow. Also, steep rocky terrain. Typically, you'll find a thinner snowpack around there. And then lastly, on slopes that have avalanched and have filled in. So they filled in from some storm snow, some wind drifted snow. Basically, we reloaded the slope. So I think those are the three types of areas where someone is more likely to trigger an avalanche. So I'm just asking people to be patient. You know, the good news is these cold temperatures has preserved the snow surface. Mm-hmm. And we have great riding on safer, low-angled terrain. And with more snow this weekend, yeah, I think we're still going to have some great options for traveling and riding conditions. So be patient out there. Give it a little bit more time. And I think we're getting close, but be patient.
Okay, thanks, Greg, and have a good weekend.
Thank you so much. You too. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Local News Hour I'm Roger Goldman. Coming up, we've got a pretty interesting show today. We're going to start our day by speaking with PC Park City Ski Patrol Union Business Manager Quinn Graves and Patroller Mike Riley about the recent patroller strike and its resolution. Then Park City Council Member Ryan Dickey will stop by with a debrief from last night's council meeting, and we'll finish our hour by speaking with Dan Tarpey, the lead counsel in a new class action lawsuit filed against Vail relating to conditions at the resort during the recent strike. I want to make clear that we have invited representatives of Park City Mountain / Vail to come on the air this morning. They were not able to do so, but did indicate that they would make Deirdre Walsh available in the coming weeks. Well, Utah leaders gathered at Deer Valley's East Village to laud the military benefits of MIDA's first hotel to open in Wasatch County Thursday. KPCW's Gray Storfler was at the grand opening.
Years in the making, the East Village Grand Hyatt Hotel's debut marked a turning point in the Military Installation Development Authority's presence in Wasatch County. At the grand opening, Utah Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson told the crowd of about 300 that the hotel, built in part to provide recreation opportunities for the military, represents Utah's values.
Part of readiness, military readiness, is recreation, is a sense of peace and solace and healing. And this place will provide that for so many military families, and that is incredibly important to the state of Utah.
MIDA is a state agency originally founded in 2007 to serve the military. More recently, some Utahns have criticized the authority's current structure, now making some of the largest development decisions in the state and levying taxes without accountability to voters. MIDA board members are appointed, not elected. Meanwhile, MIDA leaders say they're helping the state's economy and supporting the nation's service members. The hotel's opening comes more than two decades after a seven-room military cabin near Snow Basin closed ahead of the 2002 Olympics. MIDA has billed the Grand Hyatt as the replacement for that facility, with 100 of the hotel's nearly 400 rooms set aside at discounted rates for certain military personnel and some veterans. There's also a lounge for service members. It started welcoming guests in November before Thursday's event. MIDA Board Chair and Senate President Stuart Adams said the Grand Hyatt represents a significant upgrade in quality from the former military lodge at Snow Basin.
I believe Utah is the hope of America, and this facility brings just a lot of joy to all of us to be able to be what I hope is the best military recreational facility in the entire military. That's what Utah does. We build the best, and there is nothing too good for our military personnel.
Gary Barnett is the founder and chair of Extel, the New York-based development company building East Village. He said there's plenty still left to build in that portion of MIDA's Wasatch County area.
Going from here, we're expecting to build many more hotels, maybe another five, six, seven hotels, continue developing the village, retail, gathering centers, beautiful village square with ice skating.
One of the hotels still to come is a Four Seasons property. The Ski In, Ski Out Resort, announced in December, will feature 134 guest rooms and suites, 123 private residences, restaurants, and event space. The construction timeline hasn't been announced.
So really, I think making this something special for Utah, something special for the country. First mountain resort of this scale built at least in the last 50 years.
Deer Valley also celebrated the inaugural season of the first phase of expanded terrain Thursday. About 300 acres are open to the public this winter. When the East Village expansion is complete, Deer Valley Resort will approach 6,000 acres, more than doubling in size. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Okay, the strike by the Ski Patrollers Union ended Thursday after the union ratified a new deal with Vail. Here to talk about it, we have PC Ski Patrol Union Business Manager Quinn Graves and Patroller Mike Riley. Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Quinn, let me start with you. Let's do a little background. Who's included in that union?
Yeah, so our union represents both the Ski Patrol Department and the Mountain Safety Department at Park City Mountain. We represent a little over 200 folks, and because we live in what's called a right-to-work state of Utah, regardless if folks are dues-paying members or not within the union, they are still represented by the union.
And what are the differences between those two groups? I mean, we see the Ski Patrollers with the little crosses on the back, their backs under the lifts trying to keep us safe. What is the Mountain Safety Organization? How is that different?
Right. So Ski Patrol, as you just said, we're the medical first responders on Hill. We also do a lot of avalanche mitigation, different operational things, such as setting up boundary rope lines and opening and closing terrain. Whereas Mountain Safety contributes to providing a safe guest experience by like educating skiers, making sure skiers aren't going too fast. They're the folks in the yellow coats that you see in like slow zones, making sure that people aren't doing anything too crazy out there.
Okay, so when did the prior contract expire, and how and when did the negotiations for a new contract commence?
Yep, so our prior contract expired the last day of April of 2024, and so we were in negotiations from May until just the other day. So, yeah.
Now, people hear that, and they wonder what that means. I mean, that's a six-month period. I mean, we guys meeting once a week, once a month. Share a little bit of how those negotiations evolved.
Yeah, so it totally depended on just, like, the time of season and folks' availability. But we actually started meeting with the company in March prior to our contract expiring to kind of set some ground rules because, as I'm sure anyone who has lived in Park City remembers and followed the Ski Patrol union last time around in our negotiations, our negotiations went for around 18 months, so we really wanted to avoid that. So we met with the company in March and April, and then once the contract expired at the end of April, we really started getting into negotiating the articles of the contract in May. And so we, as you asked earlier, we agreed to the vast majority of our articles, tentatively agreed to them. And then once we started talking about wages and benefits, that's where we really started hitting sticking points with the company.
Now the number 27 has been floating around, 27 items. Kind of lay out for us a little bit about the scope of what you guys were trying to negotiate at the beginning.
Yeah, we opened all of the articles in our contract.
What are those?
Oh, gosh. I mean, we have anything from like education and training to contract duration to the purpose of our contract agreement. It's just everything that the company and the union agrees to collectively within a contract, and we just wanted to change language in a lot of those articles.
And Mike, can you give us a perspective on some of the more significant items that got negotiated, that got agreed to during that period?
Yeah, so during the first 7 or 8 months, we had tentatively agreed on 24 out of those 27 articles. And then in September, we had started the negotiation process over wages, benefits, and education, which is, as Quinn had mentioned, some of those sticking points that the Mountain had with us. And that was probably the longest and most challenging negotiation sessions that lasted a few months and ultimately led to some of that work stoppage.
So to sort of quote the Hamilton script, tell us a little bit about the room where it happened. Who would participate in those negotiations, and what were they like?
Yeah, so neither of us were actually on the negotiations committee. Mm-hmm. I sat in a few of the negotiations meetings, but on the company side of the table, the representatives from the company were one of their labor lawyers, an HR business partner, the chief of mountain operations, and then our patrol director. And then on our side of the table, we had our negotiating committee, which was made up of all ski patrollers, and then our union board president, and then also a staff representative from the CWA, which is our large national labor union that we're a part of. So everyone on the company side of the table, you know, those were lawyers, people trained in negotiations, whereas everyone on our side of the table, they were like really volunteering all of their own time and elected in by the unit earlier last season. So
how many representatives of the union would be sitting in those meetings?
Usually around 7.
Oh, so it's a big, so you needed a big table.
Big table, yeah. We used a conference room.
Okay. And then you also had, I think it's the one profession would be the CWA rep would be, I assume that was a trained negotiator slash lawyer of some kind?
He's not a lawyer, but he is what's called a staff representative, and we also have access to legal counsel through the CWA, but he was not usually in the room, but he was available by phone.
Okay, so the big three. It sounds like the 24 items were either, give us just one or two examples of the 24, what I would call the easy items, just so we get a sense of what was easy.
Easy items, let's see, purpose of the agreement, what
that's
the contract is about.
Okay.
the union's rights, and then also like uniforms, different policies like that are just more operational, the non-economic side of things.
It sounds like, so in a sense, talking about 24 of 27 is if you listen to that, it might be a little misleading because really it was not stuff that was all that. It sounds like it was mostly stuff that was not all that controversial to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it does set the framework for the entire contract, and it's really important. Like specifically in my case, the like grievances and arbitration article, being the business manager, that's one of my jobs is contract enforcement. So I don't want to say they were non-important, but they weren't economic. So they weren't doing anything to the bottom line of the company.
And now let's talk about the big three. What were they exactly?
Yeah, so wages, benefits, education and training, and the duration of our contract. And I can speak to some of the wins that we got there. We were able to raise wages by at least $2 an hour. And most of our unit will be seeing a $4 an hour raise. And the most tenured folks on our patrol, specifically our snow safety individuals, will be seeing over $7 an hour to their hourly rate. Which is incredible. We are really grateful for all the work of our negotiations committee and our board that's put in to really, you know, being strong and standing their ground in this negotiations process.
Was that close to what you were asking for?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and it came about in kind of a different way, but we are really grateful that we were able to secure money for our unit.
And when you say it came about in a different way, what do you mean by that?
So the company was unwilling to actually raise base wages, so they were raised with different like incentivized positions and other sorts of just kind of workarounds to get that money in people's pockets.
Okay, item one was wages. Item two was benefits. Mm-hmm. Explain those to us.
Yeah, so we were able to secure 2 weeks of paid parental leave for seasonal workers. And something that has been misconstrued just in some like media articles that have been going out is that we were asking for full-time year-round wages. Benefits. We were only asking for seasonal benefits. So that was the huge win, is that 2 weeks of paid parental leave within our benefits package.
What kind of what is in the basic benefits package other than parental leave? You know, you guys are seasonal workers. Do you get any health care options?
We do. So Vail Resorts does provide an opportunity for folks to enroll in their own health care program through the company. There is a 401k option in there. So it just depends if folks want to opt into those things or opt out entirely. So those are available seasonally, but it only lasts during the duration of the season is some of the unfortunate parts.
Have to get other coverage during the rest of the year.
Exactly.
And then the third of the big three was education. I'm surprised that would be controversial. Can you explain to us what the issue was there?
It really wasn't, but we have had like an industry-leading package of education, and so this means like professional avalanche courses, different access to different medical and trauma conferences, stuff like that. And we were just able to secure all of the things that we wanted in that package and also just add some more folks to have the ability to go to those classes throughout the season.
So again, is that an economic impact? Is there an economic impact on the company for that? Is that why it was a sticking point?
Yeah, and the company does pay for all these courses.
Okay.
So that's why, yeah, adding some more people to different courses was a bit of a sticking point. But that was less of the sticking point of the wages and benefits.
Now, as I understand it, there came a point where you accused the company of unfair labor practices.
Yeah.
Can you explain what those were and what will happen to those claims now that the strike has been resolved?
Yeah, so those claims will be resolved within the National Labor Relations Board, but we did file for unfair labor practices, and I'm sure you all know this, but we were on an unfair labor practice strike, which does harness some more protections for workers, but I can go through what some of those ULPs or unfair labor practices were. There were many times during the negotiations process where the company refused to furnish information that was necessary to the bargaining process. We also filed a ULP regarding the company bargaining in bad faith and also delaying bargaining. So from our negotiations committee on September 20th of this year proposed our economic proposal, and we didn't hear anything back from the company. They didn't meet with us for almost 2 months. And when they got back to us with an economic proposal, it was not near anywhere where we were asking. And they also came back with that counter proposal when we were all back at work. And so you were asking earlier how many times we would meet during this negotiations process. A lot of us were very ready and available to meet during the spring, summer, and fall because we weren't working full time at the resort. And so it was a really big bummer that the company delayed until the end of November when the resort was open and most of us were back full-time at work to bring that counter proposal to us.
And if I understood what you just said, did you guys not present a a comprehensive economic proposal until September?
Yeah, because we were going through the rest of our open articles prior to then. Yeah.
Trying to see what you could get resolved first before you got to the hard stuff.
Right,
basically.
That was, yeah.
Classic negotiating technique.
Yeah, okay. That was the mindset.
Okay.
And then some of the other ULPs were prior to us having a work stoppage or going on strike. The upper management of Vail, so these are, you know, people in Broomfield, they had our local management call different members of Ski Patrol and Mountain Safety at the resort asking if we would cross a picket line or stand on a picket line, which under the National Labor Relations Act can be viewed as interfering with and coercing employees. And then once we went on the ULP strike, the company did commit a couple more unfair labor practices, and so we charged them with some more of those. One of them was threats to striking workers' benefits. So this was like turning off our passes, threatening to evict people from employee housing, stuff along those lines. And then the last one that we filed was threats to striking workers' employment status.
I want to once again emphasize that we did invite Vail representatives to appear on this program this morning. They were not able to do so, but we are optimistic that we will be able to schedule. They indicated that we would be able to schedule a chat with Deirdre Walsh in the coming week, so we can get their perspective on this as well.
Great.
Two things before we go.
Mm-hmm.
Do you expect this resolution to affect other Vail resorts?
I mean, I think what we've seen throughout this process is that unions work and that solidarity works, in that, you know, we are, you know, our work stoppage was for our unit, but we also want this to affect the larger, like, mountain community and the resort community entirely. The next, like, umbrella within our CWA is the United Mountain Workers, and that represents over 1,100 mountain worker employees across the U.S. And so we want to make sure that being able to work at a resort can offer a livable wage and those kind of things. So we hope that it does influence other folks across different resorts and things. But, you know, part of our contract was not trying to raise the bar for all resorts across by any means.
Before we go, I know there are some of our listeners are going to be very interested in what conditions are like on the mountain now that you guys are back. Mike, you were out yesterday, weren't you?
Yeah. So I was scheduled to work yesterday, and it was a really exciting day. Just every patroller really eager to get back, local management so excited to have folks back, and public just embracing us and saying welcome back and giving us a nice pat on the back or a fist bump as we were skiing by or something. The goal yesterday was kind of just to get our feet back under us, tidy up the zones that we did have open, open maybe a few more runs within the chairs and zones that we had open, and then slowly expand from there. So we kind of wanted to go with a little bit of a slow and steady pace rather than just eager without, you know, any reckless kind of skiing or anything.
But we're hoping that there will be more terrain open soon?
Yeah, I think that's the goal entirely. I think we want to see more terrain open. I think locals want to see more terrain open. I don't know the plan, and Quinn and I don't have the ability to know that plan, but yeah, we would love to get more terrain open for folks to be able to ski some of that.
We've been speaking to Quinn Graves, the business manager of the Park City Ski Patrol Unit, and Patroller Mike Riley. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We'll be right back after this. Park City Council held its regular meeting last night. Here with the debrief is Councilmember Ryan Dickey, who I haven't seen for a while. Good morning, Ryan.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for being here. You know, we just had an interview with some of the representatives of the striking ski patrollers, and Park City made an awful lot of unwanted national news in the last couple of weeks. Do you have concerns about both the short and long term impacts of that on the city? And is that something you guys have discussed?
Well, of course I do. And I mean, you know, first, of course, that's a private dispute that's out of our hands. We weighed in encouraging the parties to settle, and so glad they did. You know, I had visitors over the holidays. She's a nurse, he's a firefighter, and they saved their money to buy Epic Passes and come here and ski, and didn't have the vacation of a lifetime that they count on every year, which is what we always deliver. And so, you know, they didn't really care who was at fault. What they cared about was that they came to Park City and didn't have the experience that we can always deliver, and you expect people like that will, you know, reconsider coming next year. So there could be a lag effect from that. But, you know, memories are short, and I'm optimistic that time passes and everybody remembers, you know, the Park City experience they've had in the past. But, you know, we'd be lying if we said, you know, I just think we can put a bow on this and everything will be fine.
You know, you mentioned that it was obviously a dispute between private parties, but was there anything that you think that either the council or the chamber could have or should have done differently?
I don't know. Yeah. You know, from it's hard to say. From our perspective, I think we weighed in on the dispute. I think we weighed in with a pretty strong statement, probably even a stronger statement than I would have drafted as my first draft. But that's what we did. You know, the labor disputes happen, and there are victims that are not a party to the dispute, and all we can do is try to push things forward.
Okay. The council got an update on the Clark Ranch Affordable Housing Project. Can you explain, first of all, where is the parcel that would go on? Where is that?
So Clark Ranch is our open space acquisition from 2014. It's about a little under 350 acres, and it straddles 40. So if you go out towards Park City Heights, and you're headed out of town, if you don't get on 40, in the future there'll be a little frontage road here where you'll take a right and go out past Park City Heights and go out to this open space that'll become the development. And so there's the majority of that Clark Ranch parcel was on the other side of 40, where there's just no development today. And when we purchased that parcel, the vision of the council has always been that a small portion of it would be set aside for affordable housing, about 10 acres, and the rest of it would remain open space.
And that's on this side of 40 would be the 10 acres?
This side of 40, so okay. It's on the northwest part of the parcel. So if you sort of head south towards Heber but never got on 40 and had a 4x4, you'd end up in some open space, and that's where it goes.
Okay. What is the vision at this point for that potential affordable housing?
The vision for that is a mix of townhomes and apartments. So I think something like 80% rental housing, 20% for sale. The townhomes would be for sale. And so it's large scale, on the order of over 200 units. A big development that is clustered together. So I don't think it has a too massive an impact on the landscape, but a really big impact in affordable housing, something that's really exciting. And we issued an RFP back in March. We picked a developer, Alexandra Company, and they were here. We were meeting them for the first time last night. Really impressed. This is what they do. They're a 50-year-old family-owned company, second generation. I really like them. I mean, just sometimes you know. And they came before us with a plan. And so these are sort of ballpark numbers. It's a range of AMIs. What happens here, these public-private partnerships, we have a piece of land, we go out to the market, and we say, developers, what can you do for us? We want affordable housing that's, about this much. And they come back and say, here's what we can do that's responsive to what you want. And there's probably a subsidy from the city, because 50% AMI housing is a loss to a developer, and so they look to us to make up that loss, so that it's a practical project for them to develop. So you negotiate over time about how much market rate, how much affordable, and that changes the subsidy. The deeper the affordability, the bigger the subsidy, and so we'll sort of iterate that over time, probably in a few steps, to land on a number that is a subsidy that we can stomach and a range of AMIs that have a real impact on affordable housing.
Will there be any market rate at this point? Is there projected to be any market rate units at this point?
There could be some market rate, and I think they've scoped out a little bit of market rate and some attainable, that kind of 80 to 140 AMI. But market rate is the way you can really turn the dial. So if they come back and say, this is a $50 million subsidy from the city, well, we know that's not palatable. You can insert a few market rates, that changes the affordability equation, and then you can have deeper affordability. Now, we're not talking about a subsidy, anything on that order, but more on the order of 7 to 10, 13 million.
So this is kind of an interesting, when you talk about an iterative dance, for lack of a better term.
Sure.
Everybody takes a step forward. I guess what happens is you continue to look at projected cost numbers versus revenue numbers to try to figure out that sweet spot. You're trying to have the developer make some kind of reasonable profit, I assume. So who has what leverage as this process goes through? It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, the leverage is both. And, we learned a lot on our experience, with Engine House, where you start out on the RFP process and things are a little bit closer to the vest, and then you work and you start to iterate. And in that one, we were deep into, by the end, 20-tab Excel models and private activity bonds and interest rates and working out the financing. So here, they showed us a financial model. It was pretty straightforward with private activity bonds and LIHTC and all the levers of financing that gives you an idea of what the subsidy might be. And then you just work on it.
Do we have a range of values for that potential subsidy at this point? Was that disclosed last night?
They said, based on that current model, the answer was, we don't know, but if we're making making up numbers, something on the order of 7 to 13 million.
And who is it that's smart enough to figure all this out on the, I mean, who is it that understands those spreadsheets?
Well, there's really two. There's the developer, and then there's our housing
on your
team.
Side, yeah.
So we have a lot of lived experience from the work we've done in these public-private partnerships, and then you work closely with the developer and council for whatever we know, then we start to weigh in on the process too.
And sense a timeline on this one?
We're looking to be before the Planning Commission in November of this year.
So this one, you're really trying to get this one to move.
We are going. It's big. The impact is huge. We've been working on this. This is one of those things that is just really big and really positive and something that we're all going to be proud of at the end. So right now we're in an exclusive negotiating window. So we pick the developer. We don't have a contract. When we get to that contract, it's going to have the number of units, the AMIs, the subsidy. Once we have that contract, of course, then they have to go design the project, and then they'll get before the Planning Commission.
You know, there's an interesting philosophical question about affordable housing and ownership versus rentals. Where do you stand on that sort of, do you see a role for both?
I do, but I'll tell you the council's positioning, and I share it, has really been a move towards rentals. Yeah. With our ownership units, we've run into these problems with HOA dues, where the HOA dues rise and get so high in Park City with the cost of maintaining property here and our elevation and our UVs and our snow, that it becomes such a cost burden that the unit is no longer affordable. And then we end up actually, trying to cover the gap when the unit sells. So I really, personally just really lean towards rentals.
Before we go, I want to make sure we have time to talk about the senior center. There was a discussion to analyze a different site for the senior center. I mean, for months we've been hearing about this big redevelopment project over on Woodside. Now you're thinking about another direction?
Yeah. What's up with that? We left out of the box in our thinking. So the current senior center site, what we've been pushing forward for quite a while, in fairness, is a combined senior center and housing together. It started out with, well, let's have the senior center, and then we have senior housing. That really makes sense. Senior housing is can't build with LIHTC, a lot of challenges with that. So it became senior center plus affordable housing. And iterating over time on the size of the senior center and the cost of the housing, we ended up with a really difficult financial gap, $17 million financial gap in the current model, and not a big housing impact. Obviously, the senior center portion is great. So we've been going back to the drawing board a little bit and say, before we just attack that subsidy and just figure out how to cover this massive gap, what else can we do? And this concept would be to move the senior center over onto the Mowinney parking lot. That's the parking lot across the street from the library, the sort of overflow for the film series and that stuff. Build the senior center there, put the parking back underneath the senior center, and just build a standalone senior center, which then opens up the current site for just more pure play housing. There's a lot of advantages to that. You could sort of get started on building the senior center, which is, bricks and sticks construction. There's not complexity to it. You're building a building.
Other than having to dig out the underground.
Well, that's a little bit complex, but here in Park City, Roger, we can do anything. And then the senior center, which was already envisioned for underground parking, so we're already digging. Then when you have a senior, you keep the current senior center open during the construction time, which was a real tough thing about the last one. And then you can have a more tenable housing development. It's a very difficult site if you're building a senior center on half of it to then try to shoehorn in 50 units.
It's tight.
The cost per unit is huge, and it almost becomes not worth it. And we don't want to leave behind a housing opportunity, but at the same time, we don't want to throw big dollars that don't match our formula and don't match our targets just to do housing.
What do you say to people who are like frustrated? Because it feels as though for a number of these big city projects, and I want to touch on the status of the Bonanza RFP, but it sounds like here we go again. Like we get this close and the football gets picked up because we decide we're pivoting. What do you say to people with that frustration?
I say I agree. I say I share that frustration. I think that the speed of government is frustrating, and some of that's the nature. It's a structural issue of government. Some of it probably isn't. I would say in my time here, having pushed forward 120 affordable units in town, something we've never done before, and we're going to break ground soon on a new city park building and a Mark Pool. I think we do have a lot going on. There are these high visibility projects like the senior center, like 5 Acre, that have in this inflationary environment run into some really tough cost challenges that really weren't on the table when those projects started. And so all we can do is iterate and do our best. 5 Acre, with the RFP is out over there in the project, the area formerly known as the Arts and Culture District, now known as a temporary parking lot. We have RFP responses back. We'll be daylighting those soon.
I was going to ask you about that. Those are back. Has somebody gone through them? I understand that there's no public information, but what's going on inside the, what is procedurally, what's going on
it's
inside the black
it's
box?
Moving. It's yeah. moving. So, those initial stages, part of our procurement process, aren't public, but eventually we'll bring that forward. That is in process, and that project is moving forward. Another project that's going to have a large city subsidy, there's a lot of affordable housing in that, so that'll be a big part of the public conversation, but the council has stepped on the gas on that project, so that'll be coming forward. Just like the senior center, where it went dark, it seems like nothing's happening. Some of that is procurement happening in the background. Now it's daylight, and now we're talking about how to make it happen.
And do you have a timeline for when the lights will come on with respect to that bonanza? I feel like we're talking about Prince, the sector formerly known as the Arts District.
Yes.
Do you have a timeline for when the lights are going to come on, when we will see some results from that RFP procurement evaluation process?
I think that could be as soon as February. I'm making that up, okay. But it's very fleshed out and it's exciting.
And I want to go back to Moheny just real quickly.
Sure.
If you were going to go to this model of just building a standalone senior center, would that change which stakeholders would be expected to contribute? Would you be looking for contributions from the county and from the seniors themselves? How would that work?
Great question. So we have an MOU with the county today about operating that senior center, which is coming to an end soon. And net of that is, county really does the operations. We sort of do the building. That's oversimplifying what we have today. That MOU is going to be expiring, and so we'll be renegotiating that, and probably there'll be a conversation about the county contribution to the senior center, and that we'll see what happens.
Okay, Ryan, anything else we need to touch on before you go?
No, I don't think so. Great to be here. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday, and happy end of the strike. Everybody should get out on the slopes this weekend, right?
Oh, it's going to be a great weekend.
All right. We'll be right back after this. Well, the ski patroller strike may be over, but the implications of the last few weeks could be with us for a while. One shoe dropped yesterday when a class action lawsuit was filed against Vail Resorts. On the phone, we are joined by Dan Tarpey. He's the lead attorney for the class action plaintiffs. Good morning, Dan. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Roger. Thanks for having me.
And Dan is a proud graduate of Notre Dame, and I want to congratulate him on the big victory last night.
Thank you. It was a nail-biter, an exciting game, and a little bit of Irish revelry after the game made it a little tough to get prepared to talk to you this morning, but where the Irish are good and ready to go.
All right. I appreciate you coming on with us. Okay, Dan, let's start with the basics. What are the key facts alleged against Vail in this complaint?
Yeah, Roger, it's interesting. I think there's a misconception out there that the lawsuit takes issue and blames Vail for the strike, and while a lot of the folks of Park City and who work on the mountain may be pointing that finger, may have a valid beef there. That's not our fight. Our issue is that Vail Resorts, and this has been confirmed by some internal talking points that have been anonymously sent to us since filing the lawsuit, that they intentionally concealed the strike from its consumers. The strike undoubtedly had a material effect on the operations, and the employees of Vail Resorts were told by their superiors, and I quote, to say to the consumers, the mountain is open and it is safe. We do not anticipate any disruptions to resort operations. Further down the line, when a lot of the employees are inquiring further about how they can convey this message, when it's going to clearly have a huge impact on the mountain, Vail management told their employees to say, if the guest pushes back, reach out, but let's try to preserve as many bookings as we can today. So at the end of the day, and this is the exact reason why consumer fraud statutes are enacted, is they intentionally concealed a material fact that was going to impact the service that the consumers were purchasing. And the interesting point for me in doing this, Roger, for 30 years now and handling these types of cases, both on the defense side and on the plaintiff side, I was on the mountain on December 28th. I, for the first time in my legal career, I watched a cause of action unfold in front of my eyes and had personal, you know, a personal experience with it. I recall I was riding single. I remember going up Silver Lode. I waited for 58 minutes in the singles line. They had posted that the wait was 22 minutes. And I remember riding up Silver Lode Express and saying to myself, you know, I have a season ticket. I live in Park City part-time. This isn't a huge deal for me, but I can't imagine the families that have saved up all year and have traveled out here to have this Christmas vacation and how this is impacting them. So at the end of the day, and this is, again, as I say, the precise reason for consumer fraud statutes, is that they failed to disclose a material impact on operations and told their employees to go further with that. They doubled down on it, and they told their consumers that it was going to be business as usual and that there would be no disruptions. They knew that was not true.
I want to, you said a couple of interesting things there, and I want to make sure that we clarify a couple of them. The first one is, you mentioned that you were a season pass holder. Am I correct in reading the complaint that you're really not focusing on those people as potential class members, but on those who bought individual tickets or Epic Pass limited time tickets during the holiday period?
I understand what you're saying, but I don't agree with that.
Okay, well, that's why I'm asking.
We have to take into account, right, Roger, for instance, the Basilian family, who is our named plaintiff. They bought Epic Passes, and I don't know if they had the season pass or a seven-day pass, but there are folks out there who bought a season pass, and they might only be coming out for that one trip, but financially it made sense for them to buy the season pass because, as you know, as I do with how expensive it is now, $288 a day to ski at Park City, and it is one of the most glorious places on the face of the earth. So, you know, and you know, the market's going to drive that price, and we all may, you know, hold our mouths open at how expensive that is. But there are folks that went there for that week and bought a season's pass. And because that made financial sense. So there are going to be different buckets of plaintiffs out there, the folks that maybe bought a pass just for December 28th, maybe those who bought a 3 out of 5 day pass in that window. Our class action is attempting to cover anyone who bought a ticket, whether it's a 3 day pass, whether it's a 1 day pass, whether it's a season's pass, and relied on that portion of December 28th until basically yesterday, and who tried to use that pass during those days. And, you know, along those lines, one of the interesting things that Vail also pushed out in their talking points is that they said that they were willing to refund those who had, quote unquote, unused. So if you got on the mountain, you waited for 3 hours like the Basilian family did, like the Nystrom family did, and you skied 2 runs and you said, this is ridiculous. That's not an unused pass. They weren't willing to refund that. So they basically duped you into thinking it was business as usual. And once you got up there and experienced the what an abomination it was, you couldn't get a refund at that point. And so that's, we're going to have, like you said, we're going to have a couple different buckets of plaintiffs who had different experiences. But at the end of the day, if you purchased any type of pass from Vail and intended and attempted to ski from December 27th and through January, we'll call it 8th or 9th, and then you belong in this class.
And I think you touched on something I was going to ask you, which is, did your plaintiffs or did other people already seek refunds for days that they got on the mountain and were not able to have a productive day and were denied? Is Vail not giving a refund for those days?
Our experience is that some have, people that we have talked to have. For instance, Peter Nystrom, who was featured on the Today Show about his experience coming from Minnesota, spent $20,000, stayed at a Vail Resorts property. He obviously got a lot of notoriety for his story airing on the Today Show. He wrote a letter to the CEO and the COO of Vail Resorts demanding a refund, and he contacted me yesterday and said that he has heard nothing back in return.
Okay, so let's sort of do a little bit of more formal legal stuff. Talk to us a little bit about the underlying statutory framework. What is the basis for recovery here? And then what recovery are we going to look for? Are you looking for?
Yeah, it's complicated. Basically, every state has its own consumer fraud statute, and Utah has one. And the point, I alluded to it a little bit earlier, the point of consumer fraud is that a provider of services or products cannot make a material misrepresentation regarding that service or product or make an intentional concealment of a material fact that would adversely impact that product or service. And you know, I was an adjunct professor at a law school teaching a little bit on this. And I said to my class at one point, you know, if you bought a car and you were told that that car had a 15-gallon tank and you could drive that car for 300 miles before you had to get gas, and then you bought the car and it turned out it had a three-gallon tank and you had to stop and get gas every 30 miles, you'd be a little bit upset. And that's what the consumer fraud statutes are. Vail did nothing differently here. They led you to believe that you were going to have what they say on their website is a ski experience of a lifetime. And it was anything but. So the consumer fraud statutes prevent from these material, you know, misrepresentations or fraudulent concealments that are going to impact your product or your experience. And they allow for damages, which are not only your out-of-pocket damages, which are people going to seek refund of their Lyft tickets, but there's also consequential damages. Everything that stems from you reasonably relying on the representations that Vail has made regarding their service and those damages that you suffered as a result of it, whether it's airfare, whether it's staying at a Vail resort, all of what is supposed to be part of this Vail experience, those are considered damages under the statute, including statute provides for other penalties that I won't bore you with and attorney's fees, but it is not just the cost of the Lyft ticket. There's something much more substantial here in our opinion.
So just so I understand it, if someone were to argue, hey, wait a minute, don't you have a responsibility to do your own research and understand what's going on at the resort before you come? Your point is it's reasonable to expect to be able to rely on what the resort was telling you rather than sort of putting a burden on the consumer to figure it out. Have I got that basically right?
100%. When you're going in and you're a family of five and you're spending up to $300 a day per skier, to say that it's on the consumer to find out on their own that there's a strike, which Vail did its best not to disclose. And I think another interesting point here, Roger, is that it wasn't until January 5th that Park City Mountain Resort put on its website that there was going to be disruptions. So from December 27th, when they knew there was a strike, and our complaint alleges they knew as early as December 16th that there was going to be a strike, they did everything they could to hide that in hopes that they could dupe the consumer. And as their talking points say, you know, let's try and preserve as many bookings as we can. You know, that's where the rubber hits the road, I think, for me, is that, yes, when you get there and you're having an experience, you're going to start talking. But the onus is not on the consumer. It's on the provider of the service who's charging you $300 a day for a Lyft ticket to let you know the material circumstances that are going to impact the experience.
Can you quickly lay out for our audience the expected path of a litigation like this, what the class certification process is, what one would have to do to become part of the class, those kinds of nuts and bolts of Rule 23?
Yeah, sure. The word I'd use is arduous. This will not be an easy path. You know, I've been on both sides of the ball. I'm not your classic plaintiff's consumer fraud attorney. I've represented big companies and major consumer fraud class actions. I've been on both sides of the ball. There's two ways this can go, and it depends on the level of fault. There's a lot of defendants out there who I've represented who do the corporate mea culpa. It was our bad. We're here to make it right. Let's get a settlement fund together and take care of this plaintiff's class. However, more often than not, what I expect here is that there will be a long procedural fight about whether this case belongs in Utah. I'm sure Vail Resorts will point to some fine print on their website when you click, I agree to these terms, that you relinquish all of your legal rights. And we believe that a court here in Utah is gonna step up and say, we have the responsibility to protect the rights of those who come to Utah for an experience and don't get the experience that they're promised here in Utah. So there'll be a bunch of procedural fights. They'll fight class certification, probably on some of the arguments you saliently raised. Everyone has a little bit of a different experience, and therefore we think it's more efficient if 50,000 separate lawsuits go forward than a class action. But a class action is created for this very reason, so that those folks that have already lost, you know, what they saved up for, $15,000, $20,000, don't have to go out and spend more money on an attorney one by one. Strength in numbers in a situation like these, at the end of the day, everyone faced the same exact thing, and that was that Vail misled them as to what the conditions were going to be there, what they were paying for as of December 27th.
And again, for listeners who don't really understand this, can you explain what would happen? Let's assume for the minute that you get past the class certification stage, and which is obviously a big assumption. What would happen? What would someone have to do to be included or excluded from the class? How does sort of the opt-in, opt-out process work? Because I know that some people have asked, what do I need to do to get involved in this?
Yeah, and we, trust me, once we filed yesterday, my inbox and those of my, my co-counsel here, very experienced class action lawyers, Peter Flowers and Mel Orchard, Mel's out of Wyoming. Pete and I both practice out of Chicago and Utah. We've been talking about how our inboxes are getting absolutely flooded. And you know, there is a process here, and once we get past class certification, a notice needs to go out. We're provided all the names and contact information of those folks. Once the class gets certified, there'll be a fight about that, what the definition is. And like I said, I strongly believe there will be separate buckets. Those who came and skied one day on December 28th, those who bought a 3-day pass and so forth, and they will get notifications of the class action, and they will have an opportunity at that point to opt in or opt out. Of course, there's everyone out there has their own ability and right. And I, you know, there's a lot of lawyers out there that I know that want to file a pro se complaint and pursue the causes of action on their own. But this is exactly the reason the class action statute was enacted. There's strength in numbers. You're taking on a huge corporate giant, that's a $6.7 billion company. And you might be, the minimum wage earner who got duped into this. Are you going to go out and hire a lawyer at, $800 an hour to pursue the corporate giant? Join a class, and that's the whole reason behind it. So the opportunity will be there. We believe that, and I know Vail Resorts will try to thwart every attempt to get a class certified, but we're confident that we will, and those folks will receive a notification, and at that point, they check a box, opt-in, opt-out.
I got to cut you off because we're running out of time. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll post information about this on our website.
Appreciate the time, Roger. Thank you.
I want to once again emphasize that we did invite Vail to appear on this broadcast, and we anticipate that we will be hearing from them in the future.